Income taxes. Takashi? Good job on this, Joan. Paper number five.
Okay. So the next item, the agenda paper five, discusses the presentation of income tax relating to payments on the financial instruments classified as equity. The committee discussed this issue last November, and at that meeting, the committee decided to discuss this issue further, focusing in particular on the circumstances that the requirements in paragraph 52A and B were intended to capture. Even though one of the issues included in the submission relate to the presentation of income tax relating to the cost of financial instruments classified as equity, this paper focuses on income tax relating to distributions on such instruments for the reasons described in paragraph 3 of the paper. In analyzing the issue, we first consider whether the presentation requirements in paragraph 52B is consistent with the general presentation requirement in paragraph 57 and the related requirements in paragraph 58 and 61A, and we concluded that they were consistent. We then considered what circumstances the requirements in paragraph 52A and B were intended to capture. Although it is not entirely clear whether at the time of development, the presentation requirements in paragraph 52B were intended to apply beyond the circumstances described in paragraph 52A, we think that they should not be limited to only those circumstances. In terms of the applicability of paragraph 52B to income tax relating to the payments in the submission, we think that it does apply as long as the payments in the submission are considered to be distributions of profits. And we think that assessment might require judgment. On the basis of our assessment of the agenda criteria, we recommend that the committee recommend to the board that it should propose an amendment to IS 12 through an annual improvement. Questions 1 and 2 in the paper ask whether you agree with the analysis and recommendation as summarized in paragraphs 31 and 32 of the paper. Now, I'll hand it over to the committee for discussion.
Okay. One question to Ann. Am I correct in my understanding that these two paragraphs predate all of us? They were introduced by the old IASC?
They were introduced by the old IASC.
Turn on your mic, please. There we go.
They were introduced by the old IASC, but, I mean, so was IS. I mean, they amended IS 12 that existed at that point, and these were added in. So all of IS 12 is the IASC.
Yeah, it all predates us, but some more than others.
Yes.
To some degrees more than others.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Comments, questions, reactions? John?
I mean, I think I obviously wasn't around at the time, but I do think that the paragraphs 52A and B were really designed to deal with the situation, and the whole debate around it was dealing with differential tax rates between distributed and undistributed profits and not the broader impact of tax on distributions. Having said that, I don't disagree with with a proposal to make an amendment to clarify it. I think that's an acceptable approach, I think. So I'm comfortable with what's proposed.
Okay. Bob, Tony, and then we'll start cycling back to others.
I think the staff had a good analysis of this. I understand it to be, it's the age-old question of return on capital of my vernacular, I realize, and not the staff's. We always have had issues around that, or judgments around that, but we've dealt with that in practice. So I think it's a logical conclusion and would support amendment. The one question I had, just to make sure I understood correctly, this was This would also apply if I had a fixed dividend on a preferred stock. I still would have to make the same analysis as to whether it's a return on or return of.
Tony?
Yeah, I agree with the staff's analysis. I think it is, it does reflect the way that I've always understood IAS 12, so I'm comfortable with the proposal that IAS 12 is amended to clarify it. I sort of understand concerns about differential tax rates, but I can still see the standard rate and nil being differential tax rates, and that's what the question addressed. So I'm perfectly comfortable with this as the way forward. I think the key question is, how do you distinguish between what is a distribution of profits and what isn't? And I think something for the staff to think about as they are drafting, I think they're going to get, whether it comes from the committee or constituents when we expose something, is whether there should be some indicators or at least a hint as to how you decide. Because I think that is, I think that is the key question. So I think we need to decide whether we want to give people a steer or do we want to just leave it to judgment.
Carl?
I'm also comfortable with the staff's recommendation, and probably in the same area of Tony's concern. I would go further in a major refurbishment of 52B. I think it's a very confusing paragraph. Especially the last sentence and the link with 58A, probably in the same area of Tom's concern. That would be my suggestion. I support the recommendation and would go a little further to think a better way to write 52B. I don't have a suggestion at this moment.
Bruce?
Thanks. I'm happy with this being recommended. I mean, the comment I was just going to make is, I mean, I really hadn't come across this in practice. I mean, I hadn't seen people really having difficulty with it. What I'm saying is I'm happy with what's being proposed and saying that if we are seeing people having a problem, where we're proposing getting to is what I like. So I'd be happy to support it.
Andrew?
Yeah, I also agree with the direction of travel on this, but I also agree with Tony and would go a bit further on the possible need to provide some more guidance on what we mean by a distribution. And I don't really warm to the suggestion in the paper, and I think the previous paper, that this should somehow depend or be influenced by whether something is seen as a distribution at law. And that would mean, for example, that if you operate in a solvency regime, and there are one or two of those around the world, then you never have a distribution. And that doesn't seem like a properly principle-based approach to me. So personally, I would not see a fixed distribution as, or a fixed dividend as distribution-like in character, whether or not the law said it was dependent on the availability of realized profits or distributable profits. So first look at the economic substance of whether this is a payment that over time is expected to vary pro rata with profits along those lines.
Reinhardt or Young-Soo?
I think I'm the only one who was against the amendment of 52B of IAS 16. What I originally thought was that, you know, even without the amendment, we can get to the same conclusion. But if everybody agrees with the amendment, I agree with it, so I have no problem with that. But I have some concerns about, you know, I think I'm in line with the whole Tony. Some concerns about the distinction between the distribution of profit and no distribution of profit. You know, in this agenda paper, we just say that, you know, it should be decided, or it should be judged by the entity. And that is not what I think what the Interpretations Committee has to do. We try to reduce the diversity in the practice, but we just say that, you know, that's up to the company, which is not going to reduce any diversity in the practice at all. So I think we have to think more about what is really meant by the distribution from the profit. So that's my suggestion.
That would question to my colleagues here. Income taxes was part of the agenda consultation. Where do we wind up on that?
Do you know better than me? I mean, obviously, on the agenda consultation overall,
it's still in process.
It's still in process, and I think the next step is that the staff do intend to bring a number of papers to the board in April and May that will talk about, you know, each possible sort of project area, which I think will include.
And the specific feedback that we received on each of the agenda topics, research topics.
My point being that we're all victims of our backgrounds, but I have no idea how you would determine whether a dividend payment was a payment of profits or a return of investment. And I understand how a mutual fund does it because they have specific guidance, but specific rules at least how they'll do it. But if I'm Chrysler, how in the world would I know? Befuddled at that. Anyway, that's me babbling. Reinhardt?
I think, Wayne, you just articulated more elegantly what I was going to say.
I don't know that that's possible. I thought I was incoherent.
But I agree with the staff technical analysis and with proposing an amendment to IS-12. As you said, Wayne, and as Tony and others have said, I think the issue will be determining what's the distribution of profit or not. If that's the trigger for determining the classification of the tax effect on the dividend, because I think, as you said, Wayne, in sort of a North American context, the directors are not bound by accounting retained earnings in terms of making a distribution of dividends. Accounting retained earnings is interesting, but that's not the requirement. It's whether you, as a consequence, would cause a company to become insolvent. So I can think of many examples currently in the Canadian marketplace or other countries where, you know, an oil and gas company, you've got large write-downs for book purposes. You may end up with negative retained earnings, but you still declare a dividend. I mean, is that a distribution of profit or a return on capital? So I see some challenges with that. And then the one other thing I would mention is that, which really goes to another reason why I support this as being an amendment to IS-12, is I know certainly in the Canadian context, there have been some tax issues that have arisen where the profession or practice has been to read 52B very narrowly, that it's an interpretation of 52A, and so I think that will cause, by broadening the scope, which, as I say, I personally agree with, will cause some rethinking.
Okay. Tom, did you want to come in on this?
We also we agree with what was proposed to amend IS-12, and we are also concerned about how to distinct what is the distribution of profit and what not.
Okay. Pablo?
Just to provide an example on how important it is to determine what a profit distribution is, what a dividend is, and to avoid a legalistic interpretation, as Andrew was saying. I wanted to comment on what we are seeing with contingent convertible instruments, COCOs, irrespective of their economic complexities or the incentives that are behind the issuance of those instruments, and sticking to the accounting. What we are seeing is many banks considering the distributions the payments on those instruments as dividends, but however using their legal frameworks in their respective jurisdictions to justify the deductibility of those payments and their going such deductibility going through profit and loss. So we're having situations in which we have dividend payments or coupon payments on those instruments flowing through flowing or being considered a dividend distribution, whereas they are being considered tax deductible, and that deductibility flowing through profit and loss. So it's a bit incoherent, and I think it's justifiable.
Gary?
Thank you. I'm on board with where the staff is, but with respect to research or guidance to provide on what's the dividend, a return of, a return on capital. I was on a number of outside boards and plus my own companies. Usually, the direct dividend resolutions declare where it's coming out of, you know, undistributed profits or something. So I think either getting a very high-level guidance or I think you're going to be running a risk of all the different permutations of dividends and legal structures around the world. But if you declare a dividend, someone receives the dividend, and the dividend distributor has to tell them the tax consequences. Either it is taxable income to the recipient or it's not. I mean, there actually is a declaration by the company delivering the dividend as to what it is. So the question would be is, I think the research doesn't, if you're going to do research, you don't go to the finance people. I mean, your debit can either go to retained earnings or it comes out of additional paid in capital. There really isn't any other places it can come out of. It would only come out of par if you're retiring shares. But taking something out of permanent capital is, I think, a deliberate decision, which would be par and paid in capital. But I think you'd be talking to tax attorneys, securities attorneys, you know, governance attorneys. That's who the source comes from, and I think you're going to very quickly go into permutations all over the place about it. So either got to leave it very high level, it's judgment to be determined, or it assumed it's out of retained earnings unless evidence tells you otherwise, or this is not going to end quickly.
Yeah. Okay. John, then I'm going to go to the phones, and then I'm going to try and wrap this up.
Yeah, I suppose just a note of caution on that, on trying to do anything in relation to what's distributions of profits. I mean, in many jurisdictions, you can buy back shares as effectively out of profits. So are we going to say that buying back treasury shares, the tax effect of that is also through income? So I think once you go down this path, I mean, I really don't see that you can do anything except leave it up to jurisdictional interpretation in this field. So.
I apologize. The reason we're wandering off is probably my contribution. I'm hearing a lot of support for the staff recommendation, but before I call the question, I need to ask Sandy and Fei Long. So let's let Fei Long go first this time.
I agree with the analysis and the staff's proposal to amend the IS5 to clarify that paragraph 52 applies to the income tax consequences of all distributions to holders of equity instruments. In particular, I agree that paragraph 52B also applies to tax deductible payments to holders of perpetual bonds classified as equity. Paragraph 29-30 of the agenda paper point out that the determining whether a payment on a financial instrument classified as equity may require judgment. I don't think there will be more judgment involved for tax deductible payments on perpetual bonds than for a regular dividend distribution on ordinary shares. In practice, I suspect that 52B is read as a requirement to recognize tax consequences of distributions in P&L.
Okay. Sandy?
I guess I agree with many of the things that have been said about how you determine what's distributable profit. I personally like the tax to go where the payment is, but putting it to the income statement will certainly highlight, draw people's attention to it. Many times people pay more attention to the income statement than to equity. So I don't know. I don't necessarily agree that it goes to the income statement, but it'll definitely get more attention. So I guess that means I'm agreeing with the staff conclusion.
Okay. I'm here, as I say, a lot of agreement. We just had Sandy and Fei Long agreeing with the staff. Show of hands. I think it's unanimous. Okay. That's what we'll do. Yes, Stephen.
Second question about paragraph 32. Is this really an annual improvement? It seems to me to be somewhat more substantial than that.
I think it depends on what we think it is. So I think I think as we've recommended, it's probably would fit into annual improvements. I think if we thought the amendment was going beyond that to stray into distributions of profit or what that is, it would sound like something much more.
Let me rephrase that a little bit. It seems to me that we should, the staff currently believes it's an annual improvement. Stephen raises a perfectly valid question of if it blows up as an annual improvement because people object to it, and we've seen that before, then we just either, the board is then confronted with the decision to say, well, let's just forget the whole thing, or let's go back and propose it as an amendment, which stretches out the time frame. So if, I think it's incumbent on the staff to do a risk assessment.
Yeah. I don't feel strongly either way, by the way, I don't think.
And if there's a risk that it extends beyond the boundaries of annual improvements, we'll propose it as an amendment, right, instead.
I think this is quite a big deal.
Okay. Yeah.
Point taken.
Yeah. Wayne, can I just say?
Yes, Anne.
I mean, if we, the staff proposal is to amend IS 12 to make it clear what happens to the tax consequences, but I think the staff proposal was not to put out guidance on what is or is not a distribution of profit. And if we were just going to stick to what happens to the tax consequences, I think it would be an annual improvement. And I think if we want to give guidance on what is or is not a distribution of profit, that would not be an amendment to IS 12, but would be something else.
No, I would think, I agree with you, Anne. And I apologize again. I think the distraction was my fault. The bigger question is part of the post or the agenda consultation. It goes with what do we think deferred tax accounting is, and that's a different bundle. So I think Anne's captured it for us. All right, that's what we'll do. Now we are confronted with a problem of efficiency. I'm sure anybody who wants to listen to service concessions will be expecting it to appear at 1345. So that gives us some time. And what I propose is that we bring forward the work in process portion of our, and then think about other parts of our public administrative agenda.
I can cover the work in progress and then we'll check with
Michael. Okay.
Is that okay?
That's fine.
Well, I go ahead.
Patrina's going to do work in process.
So the work in progress is agenda paper 14A. I think we followed the usual practice of splitting, you know, anything on this into the three sort of categories of ongoing, new, or on hold. Given that we have quite a long and comprehensive agenda today, that covered anything that we had under the caption of ongoing issues. On page 2 of this paper, we note the new issues that you haven't yet seen, but which we are working on and which you will see at future meetings. And then in terms of what's on hold, there's just the one that has been on hold for some time around significant influence. I will just mention as well, of course, those what's not on the sheet, but which will be occupying a lot of your time, particularly both by the way, partly in May and also then in September, is of course there are quite a lot of comment letter feedback and redeliberations to happen around both the two draft interpretations that have been out for comment, also some annual improvements that have been out for comment, and also some amendments to IS 19 and IFRIC 14. So of course they're not in here, but those the sort of comment letter summary and redeliberations around those will be occupying most of your time in both May and September as well. So maybe with that, I'll just ask if anybody has any particular questions around any of these new issues or anything else.
Okay. Michael's on his way, but in the interim, we do have a task. And that's to recognize a departing member. Andrew, would you come forward, please? Please try not to break any more furniture. Andrew is leaving before his time, off to join Upright, and we hope that promises a reasonable and friendly,
constructive,
friendly. But Andrew's been a very valuable member of the group. I was trying to remember when I met you. I believe it was when you were working for Her Majesty. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is another bureaucrat, so I better start by explaining hedge accounting. And Andrew very politely said, well, you know, actually, I was with a real accounting firm, kind of understood, and prevented me from making an absolute idiot out of myself. And that was the first of several occasions. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Wade. No actual interpretations. So should I feel good about that? I'll let you decide.
Okay. Michael is here. Michael is not here yet. Michael's going to handle the statistics.
Yeah, Michael should be on his way, I think.
Okay.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Paper 14B is paper just giving an overview of the activity that the Interpretations Committee undertook last year, 2015, and some comparisons with previous years. Now, I think in terms of overview, some of the main themes are there was a decline in the number of issues that the Interpretations Committee dealt with last year. Table 1 gives you the details of how issues were concluded during 2015 and comparison with previous years. Now, the headline figure of 27 issues is quite a bit lower than the previous year of 37 issues. But I think what that does reflect is a reduction in submissions that have come through, because if you look at the work in progress at the end of 2015 compared with 2014, it's quite similar. So I don't think it's a question of any sort of backlog building up at all. In terms of how the Interpretations Committee dealt with issues, then Table 2 on page 3, I think, illustrates quite clearly that agenda decisions have continued to be a key method through which the Interpretations Committee has responded to the questions that it has received. Now, overall, that is how you've dealt with 76% of the issues considered last year. Now, of those, of course, there's quite a number which, although the agenda decision means that you were not taking something onto the agenda, you were nevertheless able to provide some form of guidance in quite a number of those agenda decisions. And in fact, 84% of the agenda decisions, you were able to provide a technical conclusion. The other points to highlight, I'd say, I mentioned already that the work in progress and the total level there. Appendix B sets out the breakdown of that work in progress, and in fact a lot of the issues among that 20, in fact 14 of them, were tentative agenda decisions that had already been published for comment and that you've either been looking at in the January meeting or are looking at in this meeting with a view to finalisation. So we were left with just six issues which were, if you like, ongoing issues that you were still working on. I think the if perhaps we turn next to the graph on page 10, paragraph 36. This gives an illustration of the number of issues analysed, broken down by standard over the last 3 years. And these show the breakdown of issues based on when they were first discussed by the committee as opposed to when they were concluded. I think that gives an indication of the when issues were of concern to stakeholders by analysing them this way. Just a few some highlight points with regard to this analysis. IFRS 5, of course, there was a whole suite of issues related to IFRS 5 that you've been looking at, and so that, and I think together with some of the sort of momentum that perhaps builds up with something like that, where you look back at older issues related to IFRS 5 and perhaps generating additional issues coming in as well, goes some way to explaining why that was quite well, was the highest concentration of submissions to you. IFRS 10 and 11, of course. IFRS 11, there was again a whole batch of issues that you looked at collectively and finalised about a year ago relating to IFRS 11, and both IFRS 10 and 11 became effective in 2013, and so perhaps not surprising that as that standard was starting to be implemented, so it generated more issues. I won't pick out any particular other ones to focus on there, but obviously happy to take any questions relating to the other areas that are covered in the paper. There was one further analysis that I did. Gary had asked me the other day about the length of time that it takes to deal with issues. And so I did a little analysis yesterday just looking at the time that it takes from the date of the submission letter itself through to when an agenda decision is concluded, following consideration of comment letters, etc. And I looked at just the agenda decisions, given that that's how most issues are or have been responded to over the last 3 years. And if I look back at 2013, the average elapsed time was 9 months across the 16 agenda decisions that were finalised in 2013. Now, when I look at 2014 and 2015, that increases a little bit. 2014 was 11 months and 2015 was 18 months. Now, I dug a little deeper into those, and there were a few particularly long duration agenda decisions that obviously affected those averages. and a couple of examples. Well, there were six items in particular that were particularly long. In 2014, we had the agenda decision relating to going concern, which many of you will recall. Now, that was something that the committee had originally proposed an amendment to the board, but after the board discussed it and decided not to proceed, you decided to do an agenda decision on that. And so naturally, the length of time that had elapsed between the date of the letter and the final agenda decision being concluded was 25 months. But I don't think that really reflects work of this committee, because it reflects the fact that issue originally went for an amendment, obviously went through relative appropriate due process associated with that, but then came back and was finalised as an agenda decision. If I was to, if you like, do what you might call an alternative performance measure, where I was to take out the some certain particularly long ones issues where we'd originally gone down one track for an amendment, but then decided to change that to an agenda decision, then actually those averages come back down to sort of 9 or 8 months for your sort of normal agenda decisions, which simply go through the process of analysis, maybe through one or two meetings, then agenda decision that's put out for a comment, and then comments back and then finalised. So I think 9 months is a fair reflection of the average length of time that it's taken to deal with most agenda decisions.
I think, Michael, if I was going to say what's the minimum, if you think about it, if an agenda request came in tomorrow, staff would be able to work it up, but it's going to take, it's going to be 2 months before we're back together again. That's 2 months. We decide it at that next meeting and publish the agenda decision. It has a 120-day comment period. But that means it's another 2 months.
Yes,
60-day comment period, excuse me. It's 120 days before it gets back to
that's
us.
That's right.
Then.
That's right.
So all of a sudden, that's 5 or 6 months,
mm-hmm.
best case, unless we were to significantly change the due process or the frequency of our discussions. Mm-hmm. That's what we're stuck with. So the fact that the average was 9, or your alternative performance measurement is 9, isn't half bad. I don't think we should feel bad about that. Okay. Other questions, reactions for Michael? Andrew?
I think some analysis is very helpful. It's encouraging. The great majority of the issues that come to us, we do give some form of substantive guidance. But those issues typically where it's been rejected on the grounds of being too broad, we often in those decisions mention that the topic's going to be considered as part of a research project. Is there any proposal as these research projects come to maturity to sort of feed back to the committee in the future, you know, those issues where something has happened and those issues that have reached the end of the road and we are where we are and nothing's happened? Maybe I'm more for Trina as the...
I think we could certainly do that, and I can see how that would be useful.
We have done that in the past, kind of taken a sweep up of issues that we sent off into the oblivion and they never came back. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of the work we did on share-based payment was a consequence of that kind of review, so we can certainly, staff can certainly do that. Martin?
Yes, potentially have some other information that could be of some use. What I believe might be interested is the question, who is driving the interpretation committee? So that means, who was the submitter with regard to statistics? It's coming from regulation, it's coming from audit, it's coming from a user, or it's coming from a preparer. This could be quite interesting information for the statistics. The other one could be, what is the, say, average participation with regard to the outreach? because I guess, I mean, we all have our own insights with regard to country, companies, and so on, but also the participation in the outreach could be and is for sure of some importance. And last but not least, one could also add the average number of comment letters or so, which also is a quite of, well, idea about workload, what is related with the work here, and could be of some use to measure the degree of activity and concern.
I had that's an excellent suggestion. I did a little back of the envelope of that for a meeting I had with a committee in New York City. And it was actually kind of embarrassing, the comment letter part. We routinely get a comment letter from one standard setter and maybe three firms, usually two. And then sometimes somebody else who takes a particular interest. You know, we have one issue where the swap dealers have weighed in this stuff, but that's unusual. So you're right, but the comment, an analysis of the comment letters we receive is kind of embarrassing. Young Su?
You know, always worried about the time we spent to make a decision. The time is increasing, as Michael said, from 9 months to 11 to 18. But, you know, from the perspective of the submitter, 9 months is already too long. You know, after they ask a question to us, to get the answer, they have to wait 9 months. I think that is one of the reasons why we do not have many, you know, submissions nowadays. It takes too long. I mean, that's my personal opinion. So that, you know, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, from the current the format of the interpretations committee, we must spend at least 6 months or more than that. We cannot shorten it. So if we want to shorten the period, maybe we have to change some of the format of the interpretations committee. For example, we can assign a few people as a kind of full-time or interpretations committee members, and others part-time. Or we can make a small groups, like four or five people in a group. So those small groups can look at the issue in a more deeper level before we get together and make kind of some kind of, you know, the preliminary judgment or decision on those issues. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that time is important for a lot of people, for the submitters. We have to devise some way, more creative way, to reduce the time for the decision.
I've got clearly quite new to this and quite limited experience of dealing with workers through the interpretations process, but of course having been at the ISB far too long, I can only say that I would just caution against, I suppose, what I might view as rushing through change anywhere we think change is needed, because I do think that often when you look at our standards, it's actually sometimes when you're doing something quite narrow that you need to have incredibly thorough analysis and work done to make sure that all the touch points to what you're doing work. And, you know, for example, just by inserting something that we think is absolutely helpful and absolutely needed in the context of this narrow issue doesn't create, you know, new issues elsewhere. So I suppose I'd only say I think that the way you've been working is quite good, and I just think we need to be careful to be sure that where we are, you know, both providing very helpful sort of requirements and analysis and agenda decisions, as well as when we're making amendments, it really makes sense, I think, to be quite thorough and take the time needed.
I'm not saying that we should not do the due process. We should be very thorough, should be very careful. I agree with that. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that if we try to do the due process as we do right now, then we cannot but give them the same answer no less than 6 months. More than 6 months, 7 or 8 or 10, 11 months, as you mentioned. But, you know, that is not what the people are waiting for. The people are looking for the answer as soon as possible. So if they submit, they know that if they send the questions to us, they have to wait at least a year. So that prevents them from sending some kind of questions or the issues to us. So that what I'm trying to say is that there are many issues in the parliament. There are many issues for the constituents. But they don't send us the questions because they know it's going to be taking too much time.
Well, and that's, I think you're absolutely right. The alternative, which this board has always rejected, is to adopt a FASB SEC style staff inquiry system.
Technical inquiry. Yeah.
And to say that you say to anybody and everybody, you can call up and we'll give you an answer. And from the time that the board restructured and David Tweedy took over, we have consistently said no, number one, because we can't afford it, and number two, because we don't want to do it. We don't think it's a good idea. So you're absolutely right. We don't get questions that somebody needs an answer to tomorrow, because they ain't going to get it. But the only alternative approach that I'm aware of, short of the situation that I know you're experienced with the Korean board, of sometimes you have to answer the question locally. That's the only other alternative that I'm aware of. Martin?
Yeah, with regard to Yang Su, I believe the topics are not popping up that suddenly or so. I believe it needs some time to think over an issue, and issues are then discussed within the big four or five or six audit companies. And the process today at least ensures the severeness of an issue. Because I believe if in the meantime you couldn't find any solution after reconsidering the issue, and it is of that important, then it is addressed to the interpretation committee. However, on the other hand, if you say, okay, it is a kind of emergency issue task force, it could be that each and every topic which would be aligned within the big four otherwise, or within anyone who is applying IFRS in the meantime, then is addressed to this committee, and this for sure would tremendously change the way how we are working.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether this, say, case-based evaluation then would be in line with a general principle-based view on topics.
Just a question. We had a trustee review back when I first started.
Yep.
Is another one scheduled? Should
well, this just
trustee review of this committee.
Yeah. I don't know for sure, but I think that there would be one due.
Worth asking Yale and Miranda that. I wouldn't invite one, because it's more work for all of us on this side of the table. Carl, and then we'll wrap this up, unless I'll ask Sandy to come in too and Fei Long. Carl?
I would add in Martin's additional information request the geographical region from the submissions, and actually it was asked last year, and we are still without this information. I would like to see if possible before the 1 year ahead to understand a little better who is driving the submissions and so on.
That's fair. A little hard to do when we have to keep some of them anonymous, but we can work around that. Sandy, anything to add?
No, not really. I mean, I guess one thing that occurred to me when you were talking about who responds in comment letters, you know, I think it's just it's a shame. You know, we have limited resources, so we can't respond to everything, but it's a shame that we can't get more users to comment on some of these things. One, these are very technical, but there's sort of that big barrier to entry. But, you know, I think that some of these issues are so important in what they actually, they're coming to us because of what they're going to look like in the financial statement and how users might interpret the information. but it's really challenging in the way that they're written and their technical nature to actually articulate the consequence, because I think you might get more feedback if you could do that, because I just don't think that people pay attention to it. It's just so hard to sort of get through. But just one observation in, you know, some of these are pretty important in how things are going to look for ultimate users of the financial statements, and it is disappointing that people don't respond. It's an FYI.
Okay. Hey, Long, last call.
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. It's always fair. All right, let's adjourn. We reconvene at 1:45.